This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Welcome to Popcast Deluxe, your fancy star wipes of weekly cultural review. I'm John Caramonica, critic at the New York Times.
I'm Joe Coscarelli. I am a reporter at the New York Times.
Every year at this time, Joe and I look at each other or call each other or text each other. And the subject, the content of those looks, calls, and texts are.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you
facepalm?
Can you believe it?
They did it again.
Back at it. They're back at it. They're back like they left something. Who's they? It's the Grammys. The Grammy nominations are out for the, 927th annual Grammys. I'm so far into the Grammys narrative, and then I'm back out because I'm so far in. I no longer, like, I know we did the thing last week where it's like surprises and snubs, like that's a headline.
Yeah.
I lack the capacity for surprise. Mm-hmm. I do not believe anything is a snub.
No outrage.
It is a fundamentally flawed process that I understand the matrix of too well. And so it simply is what it is. And we are here this week
to talk about what it is.
To talk about what it is, and also perhaps peel back a little bit of the layer, a few layers on why they are like this. Why are you like this, National Recording Academy? Why are you like this? So we're going to talk about the Grammy nominations. We're also going to talk about The Curse, which is not the name of the Grammy nominations. The Curse is the new show from Nathan Fielder. Benny Safdie is in it. Emma Stone is in it. It is a meta dramedy about reality television and personal ethics in the American Southwest, I guess, sort of. Mm-hmm. We're going to do songs of the week. A little different this week. We're going to talk about big hits, and I with quotes, big hits by Jack Harlow and Dua Lipa.
Big new hits.
Big new. Are they? They new.
Are they big?
Are they hits?
We're going to find out.
We're literally going to assess all three of those words. And then snack of the week.
New but, YouTube channel.
Oh,
like and subscribe.
Subscribe. First of all, literally subscribe.
YouTube.com/podcast.
Not only every episode, all the audio episodes as well. If you are the type to have a logo on your screen, on your YouTube thing, and you want to listen to me talk or Joe talk. Clips, shorts. If you're only interested in what we had to say about Priscilla, but couldn't bear to listen to us talk about The Golden Bachelor, strange, but that's available to YouTube. So anyway, youtube.com/podcast, new channel, like and subscribe. A thing to which I do not like and do not wish to subscribe are the yearly Grammy nominations. I've already said my beast. On the day of, you're working hard.
Mm-hmm.
Getting Victoria Monet on the phone.
It's true. I had a nice chat with Victoria.
Yeah, Monet. You just be out here performing the labor.
Yep.
Tell me a little bit about your gut reaction to who we can get to who wasn't nominated later, but yep, to who was nominated.
Pretty normal year.
Which is to say, people being nominated, and we're just like, that's bizarre that you have 5 to 9 nominations.
But even beyond that, like, this was always going to be Taylor Swift, Olivia Rodrigo, and SZA.
Yes.
Top nominees. Mm-hmm. Fine. Good. They made work. Was it their best work? I don't know. But it was big. It was meaningful.
One of those three people, it's their best work.
Okay. I know who you're talking about.
I know you know.
Do you want me to guess?
Yeah.
SZA.
Correct.
Okay. Taylor Swift made Midnights. Fine. Olivia Rodrigo made Guts. Fine.
Karma is the guy on the Chiefs.
Karma is the guy on the Chiefs. And then there's a few wild cards. There's a lot of Miley Cyrus in here.
I have a lot of thoughts on that, actually.
I think Flowers is a legitimate record of the year contender.
Absolutely.
I
can buy myself flowers. Write my name in the sand.
Talk to myself for hours. See things you don't understand. I can take myself dancing. And I can hold my head. We can get to record of the year.
Yep.
I think I expected to see that. I did not expect to see. In fact, I had to look up what the name of the Miley Cyrus album was. It's called Endless. You know what it's called?
Because I listened to it. Endless Summer Vacations.
Okay, but you weren't positive. I think vacation singular, but yeah.
Sure. Yeah, that's fine. Much like living in Florida, Endless Summer Vacations.
Yes, not an album that needed to be recognized as a whole, but big.
But I have single. But I have thoughts on why it was.
Okay, we'll get there.
Yeah.
And then there's Boy Genius.
There is Boy Genius.
I saw this coming. Did you see this coming?
I did kind of see this coming. It's an interesting example of three artists who more or less on their own maybe would not have arrived at this, or at least certainly not this quickly.
And not
maybe,
at the top categories.
I think there's a path. If there's no Boy Genius, I think there's like a 5-year plan for Phoebe Bridgers to arrive at this.
Sure.
I'm not sure if it's what Julian Baker is striving for. I'm not sure if it's what Lucy Dacus is striving for. Do kind of think it is what Phoebe Bridgers is striving for.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's like a 5-year plan. There is something.
They cut to the chase.
There is something additive about a supergroup. Grammys love a supergroup.
It's true.
This is the Highwaymen.
The Traveling Wilburys.
Yes. These are the Traveling Wilburys, yeah, of this world.
I want to talk about commercial success, critical success, and then industry success as three distinct things, and how the Grammys try to mix all of those together when they're creating their slate of nominees. So it is created. Those are the top line nominees to me. Then you get to maybe less expected people also with a lot of nominations. Victoria Monet, you mm-hmm. mentioned, longtime songwriter for Ariana Grande and mm-hmm. many others, breaking out on her own mm-hmm. with her debut full-length, Jaguar 2, got a ton of nominations. Now, I want to talk about why that might be.
I believe I can help with that.
Both in terms of quality and, yep, and what Victoria mm-hmm. Monet does as a singer, mm-hmm. and a songwriter, and as an R&B singer specifically. Mm-hmm. And then this is where the head scratching begins. John Batiste.
No. No.
John Batiste again.
If I ever were to have words muted on a social media platform, mm-hmm. they would be John Batiste.
Luckily, I don't think a ton of people are tweeting about John Batiste.
Okay.
You're not going to mute a lot. John Batiste won, maybe think back with me. John Batiste won the Grammy for Album of the Year.
No, he didn't.
2 years ago.
That's not true.
For an album called, can you name it?
No. Is it called Music?
It's called We Are.
This is the point in the show when you literally could be making this up.
Yeah, yeah.
Genuinely, you could be making this up, and I have no idea.
Nor would any listener.
Yeah.
I'm interested in the fact that John Batiste is not popular as a musician. This goes to my question of commercial versus critical versus industry support. John Batiste made another album.
Apparently. Ben wrote a story about
yeah,
it. I knew this existed. That's the best I can say about it. It's called World Music Radio.
Yes. There is a really good Ben Cesario cover story. You thought I was going to say the album was really good.
Y'all almost got you.
Our colleague Ben Cesario, cover of Arts and Leisure a couple months back. I thought he did a really good job of putting John Batiste into context. John Batiste, for those who don't know, from a family of New Orleans musicians.
The musical director of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert.
Yes. On the very network
that the Grammys are on.
Yes.
Can I just put my Pirellis hat on for a minute?
Yeah.
John Pirellis, chief pop music critic from the New York Times, who, when words fail me, John Pirellis will often come to the rescue with a very distilled idea that only he can land on because he's been doing this for 50 years.
Yeah.
And what JP would say about John Batiste is John Batiste is a musician's musician. Mm-hmm. He's a musician for other musicians. Mm-hmm. He is someone who shows off, not necessarily shows off technique in the most flamboyant way, but shows off his historical reference points in a way that will resonate to other people who professionally make music.
Yes.
Which is why we are now resigned to talking about John Batiste. Because again. Yes.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Can we just play a song from this album? Can we just play?
Can I leave the room?
This is, I feel like, representative of the John Batiste project. This is Be Who You Are.
Free New Jeans.
Real Magic.
Free New Jeans.
Featuring Camilo and New Jeans.
And Jid.
And Jid.
Okay. No. I just, before we do this, if you work with New Jeans, if you are a member of New Jeans, just know you don't have to do this. And I say that, and there will probably be a performance at the Grammy Awards of this very song.
You think?
And it will
be because it has the most features.
Yes, and it will be hailed as a border crossing, exuberant explosion of joy. It won't be that. It is pinked by numbers, and it is unpleasant at its core, even if it is pleasant on its surface. You can only be who you are.
Crunch the numbers.
You talk to the three people who listen to this album and
No. I'm not saying that all music needs to be popular, and I'm not saying that all music nominated for Grammys needs to be popular. John Batiste's album, World Music Radio.
Yes.
Debuted at number 104 on the Billboard 200.
Higher than I would have guessed.
Sold about 11,000 copies in its first week.
Also higher than.
Including streaming, and then fell off.
Lil Wayne is on this album.
Lil Wayne is on this album, as is Jid and New Jeans. Boy Genius, for comparison, sold 67,000 albums in their first week.
Yeah.
Has already won Album of the Year at the Grammys. And as far as I can tell, does not have like a bunch of critics saying this John Batiste album, you might not have listened to it, but it's actually best album of the year. Well, my question for the Grammys is, if we are nominating John Batiste in all of the top categories for the second time on an album that is once again not really part of the zeitgeist, it's not part of the year in music,
no,
except at the Grammys, then like, why don't we see like the rapper Mike nominated for a rap Grammy, or like, I don't know, name another thing that is like not that popular, but is really like Caroline Polachek. I know she's in here somewhere, but like, why is she not nominated for Album of the Year? She's also selling about 10,000 albums.
But you know the answer to this question. I mean,
go ahead.
So the answer to this question is that the people who vote for Grammys, I mean, and they have made ostensible efforts to widen this, but the people who vote for Grammys are by and large people who have performed on a certain number of albums, whether as a musician, an engineer, a producer, a songwriter. And because of the age of the Grammy voting pool, it tends to tilt older. It tends to tilt away from younger genres, quote unquote. We are in hip hop's ostensible 50th year, but Latin, you know, the explosions in Latin music of the last 2 to 3 years, none of that is represented in these major categories. Mm-hmm. Those people, as JP would say, they favor technique, or what is perceived as technique. They favor hand-played music. Mm-hmm. They favor historically-minded music. Mm-hmm. John Batiste is a textbook. He is not, to my ear, a novel or innovative musician in any way. This has some of the worst lyric writing of any album that I've heard, potentially in my career. Mm-hmm. Is that bad?
Lin-Manuel Miranda ghost wrote this album. Am I right to think that?
No, it would be better. Lin at least has bars. They may not be bars you like, but they are bars.
Okay, I'm going to run down the rest of the album of the year category. You can hit me with some thoughts. John Batiste, World Music Radio.
Ass.
The Record by Boy Genius.
Mid.
Interesting nomination. They worked for it. They were out here. Like, if we're going to accept, and John Batiste too, if we're going to accept that the Grammys is a system that can be gamed in some way.
Yes.
It's like, we talk a lot as a popular culture about campaigning for Oscars. We never talk about campaigning for Grammys, yes, in part because nobody cares about the Grammys. This is one of my long-running things. I'm like, why do we as a culture care about the Oscars in a way that nobody cares about the Grammys? Because it's not that one is better than the other. Like, the misses in the Oscars are maybe bigger misses than the misses in the Grammys. Like, at least Outkast and Lauryn Hill have won album of the year Grammy. Yet no one cares. But Boy Genius, they are a genuine phenomenon, fan wise, like filling arenas by the end of this run. And they also worked really hard. They put themselves out there, they made themselves known, and people ate it up. So, like, I think it's interesting that they proved that, like, a well run campaign. And again, John Batiste too. He won Album of the Year 2 years ago. Like, these are well-run campaigns.
Yes. The only thing I'll say about the Boy Genius record is I just don't think this album is as good as any of their individual work.
Or the EP.
Or the EP. Definitely not as good as the EP. But I feel like, and I'm of mixed opinion on the individual work, like, of the three, Julian Baker is, like, by far my favorite.
You're a damaged person.
I mean, we've been doing this for weeks, if not months, if not years. That should be abundantly clear by now.
Yeah.
I prefer Julian Baker's work solo for sure. Phoebe Bridgers, her best work is far better than this album. Lucy Dacus is maybe, it's music that I, like, admire if I don't love it, but I can certainly say that it is constructed far, far better, far more elegantly than this album is. This album feels, it's even interesting to see, there was a, in Julia Jacobs' interview with them, they're talking about understanding that Boy Genius has an endpoint.
Yes.
And I think, not that I wouldn't have known that listening to this record, but it does feel like an album that's not aiming towards a next thing. It feels like an album that's trying to conclude, like, rushing to the finish.
Well, I think they can't even believe they got to this point. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, it was always supposed to be a bit of a lark, and it just kept growing and growing. Miley Cyrus, Endless Summer Vacation.
Okay. I hadn't actually listened to this full album until the last 24 hours. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that we've arrived with Miley at the, like, this is my, I'm a 45-year-old album, yeah, like, both in subject matter and sound.
Right.
Can we listen to a song that I genuinely think is great on this record, which is Used to Be Young? You say I used to be wild. I say I used to be young. You tell me time has not changed me. That's fine, I've had a good run. I know I used to be crazy. That's because I used to be young. This is a great Miley in the twilight of her career. If Miley Cyrus had put out this song when she was literally 55 years old, give her all the Grammys.
She is 55 years old in pop
celebrity
years.
Yeah. No, I understand. But I'm saying, like, this is, like, in normal like, rollout arc. If 55-year-old Miley Cyrus put this song out, give her all the Grammys.
It would be song of the year.
Absolutely. 100%.
Yeah.
It is jarring that Miley Cyrus has lived so much life,
yeah,
and has fully cycled back to this at this age, which is nowhere near 55. It's interesting to hear an album from her that reckons with the long arc of celebrity and about the burnout and about the letdown. But she is, how old is Miley now?
Younger than I am.
Obviously, I think she's nominated fundamentally because she's famous. But if there is sort of a quote unquote legitimacy, it's that she made an album that feels like a true late middle age album. It just happens to be hung on the back of, like, one of the 10 most famous female singers of the last decade.
I also think this is what happens when the only thing you can get any juice for in your career is your covers. Mm. And this was happening in this in-between period of Miley Cyrus post we can't stop Mike Will, Miley Cyrus, Bangers era, and yeah, whatever this is. And the other thing she did was she just made a Harry Styles album, like it's Kid Harpoon. It's like all the same writers and producers as she was just like, oh, like
I'll do that
white music, which like, fine. It worked. It worked on the Grammys.
Yes, certainly works on the Grammys.
But I think it's uneven as an album. Did you know there's a tunnel under Ocean Boulevard? That's the Lana Del Rey album. Sure also is. Nominated for Album of the Year.
A good to very good Lana Del Rey album.
And the Grammys love her. She doesn't get any love at the Grammys, but they love nominating her.
It's bizarre to me that she doesn't win Grammys all the time.
Because she doesn't play the game.
Sure. But like the music is pretty consistently good to great.
Yeah.
And I think often in whatever category she's nominated in, she's better than whoever ends up winning.
Yeah.
If it's as simple as she's her not playing the game, then that's what it is. But like I'm always a little bit surprised. Like there's an opportunity for the Grammys to do something totally unexpected, which but is also reward.
But also really in character, which is just like singer, songwriter.
Music that feels comfortable to listeners of multiple generations.
All it does is reference classic rock.
Like, right. Although I wonder, I mean, look, I'm older, but I'm not old. I wonder how her music sounds to someone who lived through the 70s.
I bet they're like,
I don't know.
Talented young lady.
But I don't know if they hear the kind of like slight tension, the slight vibration of tension, the thing that pulls it into the 2000s and the 2010s. I don't know if they hear that and feel a little bit repelled by it. I don't know.
I do think it's interesting that A&W, the Lana Del Rey song, is nominated for Song of the Year. And A&W has that second half that is like...
Do you think anybody's listened to the second
half? I don't know if anybody... I don't know if Grammy voters made it to the second half.
There is also just on... I will say, and we'll get to it, but on the John Batiste record, there's a Travis Scott beat change on that record, which is wild. And actually, low-key, the second half's not terrible. The first half...
You telling me you love John Batiste?
Stop. I will walk off this set.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made. Or how a wooden table is built, piece by piece. And in not-so-small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
I'm David Marchese.
And I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro.
And we're the hosts of The Interview from The New York Times.
David and I have spent our careers interviewing some of the most interesting and influential people in the world.
Which means we know when to ask tough questions and when to just sit back and listen.
And now we've teamed up to have these conversations every week. We'll try to reveal something about the people shaping our world.
And we'll get some great stories from them, too.
It's The Interview from The New York Times. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The Age of Pleasure by Janelle Monáe, nominated for Album of the Year.
A traditionalist in futurist clothing. I think about this the way I think about the John Batiste record, which is that it shows its work. It shows what it's in discourse with. It's mindful of the fact that listeners are likely to bring a set of historical references with them. And this album wants to play with that and say, I too, yes, I know what you're coming to the, I know what you came to the door with. I also listened to that. It did when I was listening to this album back to back with John Batiste. It felt like they were solving similar problems. And frankly, it's not that disconnected from the Grammys' larger issue with R&B, which is that it leans extremely traditionalist with R&B. This is a success as an outlier, but it does lean extremely traditionalist with its R&B.
We're going slightly out of order here, but says SOS, nominated for Album of the Year.
Great record. No notes. Happy to see it.
Could it win?
I just don't think it's going to be Taylor or Olivia or John Batiste.
That's the real one. And those are the last two. Midnight by Taylor Swift, Guts by Olivia Rodrigo.
I will say this. Something I found myself surprised by. Like, as you said, everything you expect. There's Taylor nomination. There's Olivia nomination. If you had asked me the day before the Grammy nominations came out, what's the animating tension of the overall nomination? I would say it's Taylor versus Olivia. It's in a weird way, it's distracting from, look, Taylor, Midnight's not my favorite Taylor album. Guts, I don't think, is my favorite Olivia album, but these are two of the most important pop musicians of the last 20 years. Why is this not a sort of like face off between them? Instead, there's a lot of clutter in this category.
I think people are a little nervous to think about them as a head to head. Like, I think even pop fans,
not on podcast.
Well, but I think this has been in the air all year, is like, what is happening with these two, who at once seemed like they were going to be harmonious and now are clearly in something of a cold war. And I think going into the show, maybe that will ramp up again. Oh, it's Taylor versus Olivia in the top three categories, with Antihero and Vampire in song and record. I think Antihero is probably the best Taylor thing in this whole mix. And I think Antihero does have a chance in one of those song categories. I think if Taylor wins for Midnights, making her the only person to ever win four Album of the Year Grammys, like, that's a little bit of like anticlimax, because I don't think it would be an award for Taylor's year. It wouldn't be an award for Taylor's album. Right?
Sure. But like, you're presuming that like the Grammys are somehow giving awards purely on the merits of one piece of music. We know that that's not the case.
Fine.
Because if that was the case, half of these nominees wouldn't be here.
The other thing that can happen in this situation is a vote split, which I think 8 nominees.
Or everybody just votes for John Batiste. Like,
so are we just giving John Batiste the Grammy right now here?
We?
In November? I mean, it seems like the most likely, like, are we so beaten down by having covered this show for however many years we have that we're just resigned to the fact that John Batiste is going to win?
You know what lightly slaps? The Kenny G song.
It is true that the features on this album include New Jeans, Kenny G, Lil Wayne, Jid, and Lana Del Rey.
Go off, John Batiste. I apologize for everything I've said for the last 20 minutes. Do you want to talk about the other categories that are the big categories, but artists who are not nominated in an album?
Yeah. So that's
the basic playing field.
That's the playing field.
But there are a couple things. There's the Billie Eilish, What Was I Made For, which is from Barbie.
Mm-hmm. Which Barbie was the most nominated album in all of these nominations. And yet it was not nominated for Album of the Year, which I think is interesting. Why not?
I agree. Should have been. Could have been. Certainly with these.
Like Black Panther soundtrack was nominated for Album of the Year.
Also, what I would say is a lot of nominations for Barbie, no nominations for The Idol. Simply saying.
World-class sinner. Robbed.
What Was I Made For? A classic Billie Eilish.
You love this song.
I think it's really good. It is absolutely in keeping with everything. Like, shouts to Billie Eilish for like both understanding the assignment and also being like, how do I make the most Billie Eilish ass Billie Eilish song and still have it understand the assignment? Like, absolutely perfect.
Going up in Song of the Year against another Barbie song, Dance the Night, the Dua Lipa one.
Yeah, it's a pass.
Okay.
Pass. And then On My Mama, which is the Victoria Monet song.
Yeah.
Cool song. Personal, shout out to Charlie Boy.
Oh my mama, oh my who, I look fly, yeah. I look good, touch my sway.
Great record. Shout out to Rapid Rick. Like everybody who was doing Texas stuff in like the mid to late 2000s, like here, we've arrived here now. Mm-hmm. This is, again, a R&B song produced by D. Mile.
Right.
Who has had a tremendous amount of success with Silk Sonic. With
and her.
Yeah.
This is Grammy's core.
It is a song premised upon a song. Now, I would venture to say most Grammy voters don't know the Charlie Boy song, but they probably understand the phrases. They know the phrases. They understand the catchphrase. It feels like a song that is contemporary, but not as youthful as maybe a lot of the R&B that it's in conversation with. It feels much like the Janelle Monáe record. Like, you hear the antecedents. And I think if anything spoke loudly, it's probably that. Also, I don't know, like, who does D. Mile know? 3 years running now with nominations at this high level.
Yeah, dominance. He's also nominated for Producer of the Year.
Yes.
So the Victoria Monet On My Mama is up for Record of the Year, which has stuff we've already run down, except Worship is the John Batiste song, we'll just pass. When you get to song, which is for the songwriter, as opposed to the producer and the performer, that's where you have the duo song facing off against the Billy song. You have Kill Bill, SZA, Vampire, Flowers, Butterfly. This is the Jean-Baptiste ballad with Dan Wilson, who is still getting mileage out of having written Closing Time. Just like, we're just always going to be like, huh, isn't it weird that the guy who wrote Closing Time makes pop records? And it's like, no, it's not weird anymore. A&W and Antihero.
Yeah.
Fine. Like, this is fine. If you take away the Jean-Baptiste, like, this is a representation. Like, this is where I guess my question is like, okay, Boy Genius, critical, favorite, commercial enough. Everything else, Taylor, Olivia, Miley, hugely commercially successful, critically liked, if not loved, sometimes loved. And then Jean-Baptiste. Nothing. So it's like, what, like, the Grammys has done.
You every time you say the word Jean-Baptiste for the rest of the episode.
The Grammys has done a better job in the last, let's call it 10 years, of representing commercial success in music. Like, this is the year in music.
There are no hip-hop records here. There are no Latin
records. What should be here?
There's no, I mean, there's no what country records.
Okay, so let's talk about the country thing.
Okay.
That's the argument.
So there's, again, no hip-hop, no Latin, no country.
And what rap stuff belongs to?
Well, first of all, no, let's start with country. It's been a huge year for country. Obviously, you have to face the Morgan Wallen conundrum, which is he rehabilitated enough in public perception? Clearly, the answer is no. Also, the CMAs came home nothing.
Nothing.
So clearly, there's still work to be done. If he ever gets rehabilitated in that sense, one nomination for a song of his, but he's not a songwriter, so no nominations for Morgan
Wallen.
That
feels pointed. Yeah. The single nomination for last night,
yeah,
a song that he did not have any hand in writing.
Yeah.
That feels pointed.
Absolutely. Luke Combs' cover of Fast Car, also a song. He didn't have a hand in writing because it's a cover. But a huge song this year. It feels ripe for a, God forbid, a Grammy moment. I don't know if Tracy Chapman will leave the house for this. Tracy Chapman seems to be doing totally fine, watching this happen from a distance. And since she owns all the publishing, I assume collecting checks. Great. We love that for Tracy Chapman.
The Kate Bush of 2023.
Love that for Tracy Chapman. I do not know if they will find a way to get Tracy Chapman on that stage.
Not nominated for Record of the Year. It's insane. It was not eligible for Song of the Year because it was already nominated for that.
Right.
When it originally came out.
Yes, in 89.
Why? Like, what happened?
Really, really baffling. Oliver Anthony?
Did you expect to see Oliver Anthony?
No, but like I can see it ending up in one of those categories that's like a lower, like a regional roots music category or something along those lines.
Don't you think he probably did not submit?
I think he did not submit it. I think he did not submit it. However, I will say in our Grammys, he ends up somewhere in there.
Our Grammys is a scary thought. Best New Artist, Tate McRae.
How did you feel about the Best New Artist?
Yeah, let's run down Best New Artist. We got Gracie Abrams.
Fine.
Fred Again. Good. Ice Spice.
Great.
Jelly Roll.
Great.
Coco Jones.
Good.
Star of Bel Air. Remember when you asked me what is Bel Air on Friday?
I apologize.
Noah Kahan.
Telling because Zach Bryan was not nominated last year. So you're going to nominate Noah Kahan this year.
It's not a 1-to-1.
No, it's like a 1-to-0.3. Sorry. It's odd to not nominate Zach Bryan in the year of Zach Bryan's ascent and then to nominate the person who is most directly benefiting from the rise of Zach Bryan.
Victoria Monet.
Sure.
Much like Jelly Roll, not a new artist, but a new artist.
Yeah, Jelly Roll. Yes. Yeah, right. We're overlooking like Jelly Roll's like 8 rap mixtapes. So like, yes.
The War and Treaty.
Fine.
What's going on there?
Yes. Married duo, black country singers, but not mainstream Nashville country. Like, if you had to place them somewhere, they are on the more historically aware side of, forgive me, Americana. But I think we're signed to a country major over the last couple of years. I assume in hopes that they would catch on more broadly. They're on the most recent Zach Bryan album. I find it's really well-made music.
Grammys love that.
Yeah, it's like extremely well-made. I don't know that I love it, but it's like extremely well made. They sent the voices out of control.
Like when someone wins a Golden Globe and they give like a barn burner of a speech and then everyone's like, ah, like they locked up the Oscar with that.
Okay.
Because like we want to see them.
Yeah, sure.
Do another version of that again in primetime.
Yeah.
Jelly Roll locked up this Best New Artist
with that
CMA speech.
Yes, the CMA speech. And also, did you see his IG? I don't know if it was a live or just a video that he posted on his Instagram.
He's reacting
to the Grammy nomination.
Floating.
Jelly Roll.
Come on, Popcast.
Yeah, like, no, we're making those calls.
Yeah,
absolutely.
But I think, yeah, the fact that Jelly Roll became like an inspirational meme, like people were putting church organs behind his CMA speech.
I don't know where you're at in your life or what you're going through, but I want to tell you to keep going, baby. I want to tell you success is on the other side of it. I want to tell you it's going to be okay. I want to tell you that the windshield is bigger than the rearview mirror for a reason.
He's like, you got this, like you could do this. Like what he said something, he dropped a real bar that was like, the windshield is bigger than the rear view for a reason. Like something like that. Like incredible stuff. Does anyone else have a chance in this category other than Jelly Roll?
I could see this being the place if they keep Victoria Monet out of the bigger categories. Mm. I can see this being the place that Victoria Monet gets rewarded. Huh. But like I agree that the sort of the title movement does seem to be behind Jelly Roll. But who would I like to see win?
Ice Spice.
Obviously.
Maybe this is where rap is recognized in the top category.
I mean, you do realize that the only rap nomination in any of the four categories, assuming you're not painting SZA as a hip-hop right. singer.
Or Lil Wayne and JID on the John Batiste album.
The only real rap nomination is Ice Spice in Best New Artist.
Yes.
That is baffling to me.
So this was my question. It's like, usually we think, how dare the Grammys not recognize the greatness of contemporary rap music?
Lil Wayne.
You know, and now I'm like, but what should have been here? What should have been here? Let's look at the best rap album category because it is slim pickings. Like you wanted to see the Metro Boomin album in the top categories?
Tell me what's in there.
Killer Mike, Nas. And then Travis Scott, Utopia. I mean, like, we're not working with a lot here. You wanted to see the ...? EP and album of the year?
I mean, it's going to be on my top 10. It's going to be on my year end list for sure.
But is that, that's it?
Hood Hottest Princess?
Could have gotten an album nomination for Sexy Red, rap album, but I don't think we're ever going to see that in the top categories. Imagine like the committee, like the meeting, you know, where they're like pressing play in the room and it's Pound Town.
Our Grammys.
Ski. Like really, like what were we supposed to do?
What are the biggest selling rap albums of the year?
I think I just named them.
No, there's got to be others. Is it that bad?
I think it's that bad. Like, is we want for, these okay, in here?
Is it For All the Dogs? I know Drake's not submitting, but is it For
Her
All
Loss? Her Loss is in here. He's seemingly agreed to submit for 21 Savage.
The Offset or the Quavo album? What about Doja?
Doja Cat. That's, I mean, I'm surprised.
Are we putting Rod Wave in this category?
You think that Rod Wave album belongs in Album of the Year? Doja Cat, I was surprised. I think
Gunna?
Attention. Okay, Gunna is surprising.
Yep.
F You Mean not being in Record of the Year.
I agree.
Shocking. Mm-hmm. What is that? Are they avoiding the did Gunna snitch conversation?
No, I think they just genuinely don't listen to it. I just think it's just genuine.
But it's one of the defining songs of the year, no?
I don't disagree.
That's why I'm just like, what is this for?
Uzi?
If it's not, you want like, what, like.
No, I'm done. I'm throwing out names. Literally just throwing out names.
This gets to the ultimate question, which is like, if it is a representation of the biggest, most important music of the last year,
it fails.
You need Gunna in there and you need Fast Car in there and you need Morgan Wallen in there mm-hmm. and it fails. If it is somehow splitting the difference between commercial and critical tastes, it still fails. And it fails in this slate fails in a more interesting way to me than most because of the people who are getting vouched for outside of popularity and the people whose popularity was not enough to get them into this club. Any other categories in here that stood out to you? You want to jump through real quick before we go?
No.
You watch anything good on TV this weekend?
Also, no. No, I'm being unfair. We watched The Curse. It's the new show from Nathan Fielder.
Giving money to that little girl over there.
We're doing good here. We are good people.
Thank you.
We're really good.
Got it.
So all I had on me was that $100 bill.
No refunds.
That's not fair.
It is fair.
Let me go get change and...
What is that?
That's nothing.
This is... You don't need to see this.
Why did you snatch back the money? Why didn't you just give her the 100?
I was going to buy six of them for $20.
I curse you.
The third big show from Nathan Fielder. This is a meta. It's a fictionalized meta reality show about essentially what feels like the making of a Nathan Fielder type show.
Yes, or the making of a show that Nathan Fielder would then parody in his own show.
Correct, yes. Okay, so talk to me before we get into the weeds of this new show. Nathan Fielder's particular form of comedy has now spanned at least two prior shows in about a decade, starting with early Nathan for You in like the mid-2010s.
Yeah, so
What is Nathan for You? What was its innovation?
So this was a Comedy Central show that was a satire of an HGTV show,
sure,
like mm-hmm. Bar Rescue or Kitchen Confidential.
Mm-hmm.
And Nathan would go into small businesses, real small businesses mm-hmm. in Southern California with increasingly zany and absurd ideas for how to improve their business, basically pushing these small business owners, often immigrants,
yep.
people of color,
mm-hmm.
Into uncomfortable situations to elicit a comedic reaction.
I'm going to put comedic in quote marks there.
Yeah. All about making everyone uncomfortable.
Yeah. I often struggled with this show because I feel like the comedy was in quote marks. I feel like these are actually shows about morality and they are not shows that are, I mean, I don't want to get philosophical about what is comedy.
Sure.
Couldn't you have something that's comedic that doesn't make you laugh? Like, of course you can. But to me, these were always shows about morality and power.
Yeah.
But I almost venture to say that they were more about morality and power than even Nathan Fielder was totally dialed into during the making of the show. And only in subsequent shows, The Rehearsal and now The Curse,
totally,
is he reckoning with the way that morality and power played on Nathan for You.
Yes. So then comes The Rehearsal, this HBO show from last year.
Can I just say, did you watch Nathan for You from like episode one, season one, or like,
yeah, basically I watched it chronologically.
And you enjoyed it?
At times. I think like some of it is more successful than others. I think definitely it skews toward amoral.
Yeah.
It's quite mean spirited. I think it comes out of this tradition, which I think starts with Sacha Baron Cohen, sort of, who is seen as like a godfather of this reality comedy genre. But Sacha Baron Cohen was always doing it in attempts of punching up.
Yeah, skewering power.
Or at least punching down, but bigots. That was his thing. Exposing people saying things they shouldn't have said.
Exposing vile ideologies or exposing hypocrisies of power,
yes.
Which, again, totally notable function of art, function of comedy, like really, really noble.
Right. Whereas Nathan Fielder seems to take the idea of reality television as grotesque. And he's sort of holding up a mirror to reality TV and being like, this is how grotesque you're being, by also participating in those grotesqueries. So then you get The Rehearsal, in which he seems to be grappling with having done that.
Yeah.
The idea, this is like a very, you know, these are Russian nesting dolls.
Yes, they're deep, very, very interwoven.
All of this, I think, has a lot to do with Charlie Kaufman, the movies of Charlie Kaufman, you know, thinking about Synecdoche, New York, or being with John Malkovich.
I mean, it doesn't have to do with Impractical Jokers.
and with some Impractical Jokers. This show was produced, Nathan for You, by Tim and Eric.
Mm-hmm.
This is a strain of comedy
mm-hmm.
that I don't know much about mm-hmm. and that I have not participated in. but then The Rehearsal is this idea that what if you can rehearse everything that might possibly happen. He mm-hmm. says this idea came to him when he was thinking about making Nathan for You and trying mm-hmm. to anticipate how sure. the people in the show would react. And then by the end, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen it, it becomes people being like, Nathan, you're manipulating people for your own ends. And what does that say about you as a human?
Yes. Although, and I do feel like we never fully answer that question.
Right.
There is also, you were mentioning before we started taping, there's the vulture profile of him from this time period.
Yes, from right before the rehearsal by Leela Shapiro. Great piece.
Really, like, the piece you should have someone read if you're going to want them to understand what he's about. But it's also interesting, the reckoning of his personal relationships, like the dissolution of his marriage, the way that he has chosen to seemingly externalize, like even in conversation about personal things, like externalizing it and sort of like, I can solve it, but I can solve it by like working other people. I don't have to solve it myself. And I feel like even throughout the rehearsal, a show that I mostly enjoyed, at the end, I'm still left with this kind of like, why are you so broken, man? Like, so broken.
Which seems to be the question that he is asking.
And I understand.
But not answering.
But just because you're asking it, that's not like, that's like going to therapy and being like, I got some things to work on. And then like, what, am I done? Do I get a 10 out of 10? It's like, that's not how it works.
Yeah.
And
it definitely didn't fix anything.
No. And if that is the, like, I'm not saying it's not a valid creative choice, but I am saying like, in a show that had a number of creative choices that resonated for me, that was a creative choice that I felt was a cop-out.
This year, a very important public figure turns 80. He sent us his wish for his birthday.
My wish is for everyone to practice wildfire safety, because only you can prevent wildfires.
That sounds easy enough. Bet you don't know who it is. Nah, of course you do. It's Smokey Bear. Let's all make sure Smokey's wish comes true by learning his wildfire prevention tips at SmokeyBear.com. Because Smokey Bear lives within us all. Brought to you by the USDA Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
And then here we are in this fictional show.
Yes.
This is, or is it? We'll talk a little, I want to talk a little bit about the casting and the use of quote-unquote regular people.
Yes,
of course. Which is a Safdie Brothers thing in the same way that it is a Nathan thing.
Yep.
This show is co-created with Benny Safdie. Mm-hmm. It's cast.
Who's also in it.
Who's also in it. It's cast by Jennifer Venditti.
Shout out Jennifer.
Who does a lot of this stuff.
Yes.
Euphoria, movies of Andrea Arnold, Safdie Brothers. Mm-hmm. This is a type. This is now an archetype.
This is a person who specializes. I mean, I profiled her a couple of years ago. This is a person who specializes in casting.
Street casting.
And true people, for lack of a better way of putting it.
Authenticity.
Like, yeah, I mean, these are all fake terms, but, you know, people who are not necessarily seeking to be on A24 shows, but who would really do a great job of rounding out what an A24 show would look like.
And the rehearsal is literally an A24 show.
Yes. Sorry. Yes. Should add that.
Nathan Fielder plays a character by the name of Asher Siegel, maybe an alter ego of sorts. And he and his wife, Whitney, played by Emma Stone, are making a HGTV-like reality show in a community in New Mexico.
Espanola, a real town
north
of Santa Fe.
And these are characters who are presenting themselves as do-gooders in the town.
Yes.
They are doing gentrification, but in a good way.
We're good people, as they say over and over again in various contexts.
And yet they're being pushed by the Benny Safdie character, television director and producer.
Great rings.
Yeah.
I should have worn rings. Actually, I'm thinking about wearing rings in honor of the character. Maybe next week I'll do it.
And he's pushing them further into amorality, which is a place that they may be comfortable anyway.
Yeah. Like, historically, what we have thought about structured reality television, HGTV-like shows, there's no meta. You watch Fixer Upper. There's no real meta narrative. Maybe the meta narrative is about the family. Maybe it's a really benign kind of through line about, oh, a couple, they're kind of like, oh, you know, when it comes to the furniture, like, we always disagree about the budget. Like, but it's not big picture stuff. But there have been reality shows in this space that have actually ended up leaning in sort of, I think there's one called Windy City Rehab, where there was a bit deep. Yeah, where there's like a lawsuit between the main character, who's like the designer, and maybe the main contractor, but it sort of gets woven into the show itself. It's not that it's impossible that those two things can mix, but they're not historically, they don't historically mix. And frankly, shows that have dealt with gentrification, like in the truest sense, like there's one about turnover in Detroit that I'm thinking of, one about turnover in, I believe, Indianapolis. Gentrification is a subtext, but it is almost never overtly referred to.
So now we have a show, a fictional show created by, about making a reality show, created by somebody who once made a real reality show that was critiquing reality shows. Mm-hmm. And we're so far in this, down this rabbit hole, that I just cannot tell who is being held to account anymore. And I think this is ultimately another chapter in Nathan Fielder trying to, I don't know if atone is the right word, but again, grapple with the fact that he is this person, even if he started out trying to satirize this person. And yet the show, as you alluded to, is like all about discomfort.
Yeah, it is this. I don't know if I liked or disliked this show.
Yes.
But I do know that for an hour, I was extremely uncomfortable. There is no person with pure moral intent, or almost no person. None of the main characters have pure moral intent. And again, I'm not a person who like has to have my popular culture ribbon through with morality. It's not that at all. But the way that it chooses to press buttons feels, on a fundamental level, cruel. It's cruel. People are being cruel to each other. They're being cruel to their like victims, which are the people they're trying to help. There's no one to root for. You're only rooting against. And again, that's fine, but it creates a tremendous amount of discomfort.
Unless you're rooting for the kids who put a curse,
I suppose that's
on
true.
These characters, which yes. happens halfway through the first episode, mm-hmm. the titular curse.
Are you rooting for those kids?
I want to see how things play out.
Do you think Nathan Fielder is fundamentally in atonement mode? Because to me, if anything, it is a new context for amorality. It's not a rejoinder to amorality. It's I've burned the first path to it. I've then burned the second path to it. The only way I can possibly have a continued path to amorality is to, in effect, satirize my satirization of my satirization of reality television, building one additional layer of meta narrative on top of this.
But I do think he's making the subtext the text, and I think that's in part because these conversations have spilled into public. The Vulture profile you mentioned of Nathan Fielder interviews people who were in Nathan for You, yes. some of whom say they felt taken advantage of
sure.
and made fun of. And some of whom say, like, I had a great time. I knew he was doing a bit and I played into it. Mm-hmm. And we all had fun and we came out the other side. And I think I think he still thinks ultimately he is the punching bag in most of his work. But I think he realizes now that not everybody feels that way. And it seems like we're diving deeper into his psyche, which, again, going back to this idea of a filmmaker like Charlie Kaufman, who is like, I am, you know, an asshole. But how does that affect the people around me, mm-hmm. my sort of neuroses? And I think is Nathan doing it in a way that will get him through the pearly gates? Like, I don't know. I agree. Like, it keeps getting grodier and grodier, which I do think makes for compelling art.
Yeah, it's an interesting example of a show that does not function on traditional vectors of quality or enjoyment. It's absolutely a commitment. It is a commitment to seeing through a moral quandary. It's really just some ethicist-ass television.
And yet there's this other level of absurdity. Like, I think, in fact, we shouldn't spoil what happens halfway through this show.
Okay.
When you realize it's about something else that he and his father-in-law have in common. I'll just leave us with the term cherry tomato boys. Which, like,
I talk about a narrative I wish to be removed from.
I think we should probably watch all of The Curse and maybe come back to it, because I do not know where this journey is going.
Speaking of journeys that I know exactly where they're going, because I know exactly from whence they came, should we talk about songs of the week?
Yeah, we're going to run through two of the big songs of the week.
Yeah, so this is going to be a little bit different than in other episodes, which are maybe more songs that we love, and even maybe songs that we are
recommending.
Yes,
we're pulling from the mess.
Yes. Why don't you take your song first? Because we're both doing big records. You do yours first.
Dua Lipa's back.
You sure?
Back from her Barbie soundtrack.
Like,
song?
Returned.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
Okay.
New single called Houdini, produced by Danny Harl.
Okay.
PC Music.
Sure.
Tobias Gesso Jr. Indie rock.
And Adele.
and some Adele.
And some Adele.
And some guy called Kevin Parker. It's Tame Impala.
As I have said,
yeah,
you do not need to work with Tame Impala.
I'm not even really picking this song as a song of the week. I'm more picking the music video as the song of the week. Dua Lipa did not reinvent her sound with Houdini.
Did Dua Lipa sing this song?
No idea. Some cool production. Seems intricate.
Say what
I'm interested
say,
here
say
is Dua Lipa is the pop star of the moment, maybe, like, capital P. We talked about if pop music was broken. Dua Lipa is a pop star.
Okay.
She's a normal pop star.
Yeah.
But the criticism last time around was, you're making all this dance music and you're giving us nothing, girl.
Go ahead, girl. Give us nothing.
You just don't really dance like the pop girl that you're supposed to be. So Dua Lipa hit the gym.
The dance studio.
Yeah, figuratively. She's like, okay, here is my comeback music video, and it is just me in the dance studio dancing. No bells, no whistles, no plot, just dance studio. Did Dua Lipa learn to dance? She's pulling it off. How many takes do you think they did of this Houdini dance?
I don't have an answer to that, but I do find it fascinating that you wanted to talk about Dua Lipa's dance studio video after maligning Tate McRae. And I don't know what you've been saying about Troye Sivan in your off hours. I have no idea. But, like, what I'm struck by is we are clearly back in a moment where pop stars are like, I'm going to show the work.
Yes.
And, like, Dua Lipa has historically been a pop star who does not show the work.
Yes.
When I say, is Dua Lipa singing this? I know that sounds like an insult, but the thing is, this could be an AI Dua Lipa record. Like, it is so synthetic. There's almost no kind of, like, texture or burr on the voice at all. Another thing I was thinking about watching the Dua Lipa video is the real Dua Lipa, like the real Ashley O, like, hooked up to some medical equipment somewhere? And this is purely just, like, management controlled, like, virtual Dua Lipa. And they're like, you dance now, and then it dances, and then they don't have to worry about whether actual Dua Lipa can pull off the dance moves because the virtual one can.
If Dua Lipa is software, she is learning. Let's listen to Houdini, but better yet, youtube.com/podcast. Let's watch Houdini.
And subscribe. You know who else is learning?
Yes. I know where you're going with this.
Not no.
What's your song of the week, John?
We didn't come to talk about pop stars who are iterating and learning in real time and folding new dimensionality into their presentation. We didn't come this far to not talk about the new Jack Harlow song. So the new Jack Harlow song, it's called Lovin' on Me. And like, if we're to keep it a buck, the new Jack Harlow song is, there's two things that are crucial about this song. One is the sample.
Mm-hmm.
Cadillac Dale. This is like a great sample, and that was essentially a fundamentally unknown song by a Detroit R&B singer from the mid 90s. Cadillac Dale is the song, is the singer.
Yeah. Also known as just Dale.
Just Dale.
Which, great name.
The song is called Whatever, Bass Solik. I don't know about all that. It's on the A side. The B side is a song called Soulful Moaning.
This is a Discogs classic.
Literally too hot for podcasts, whatever's going on there. So it's partially about that, but it's about the TikTok trend. You know I like Jack Harlow. And you know that I also had a long conversation with Jack Harlow on the last album. Well, I guess technically, yeah, the album, not the mixtape after the album. Right. The album.
So this is Jack Harlow returning from.
So there's actually
a mixtape.
Yeah. So it's Jack Harlow album, then Jack Harlow Take Me Seriously as a Lyricist mixtape. Now it's I Want to Be a Sexy
Hit Again.
I Want to Be a Sexy Boy.
With a mullet.
A mullet, some clothes that show off his body. look, here's a, like
something else he has in common with Dua Lipa.
I just want to know what the moment was like when they landed on I'm Vanilla Baby. Like, I'll choke you, but I ain't no killer baby. Like, you can already see the TikTok. Like, obviously, anyone in that studio saw the TikToks coming. I don't know if anybody in the studio saw that Rubik's Cube guy coming. Talk about glow ups. That's
good for the Rubik's Cube.
Great guy. For the Rubik's Cube guy. Like you did your thing. This is a song. I'm also shocked at how often the sample repeats throughout the song.
I mean, it's a great sample.
It's a great sample, but there's the second verse runs as a full verse, but the sample keeps repeating through the first verse. Anyway, I don't know what the next Jack Harlow album is going to sound like.
Is it going to sound like The Motto and Truffle Butter?
Yeah. Totally. I mean, would that be so bad, frankly? But this is designed to gather attention. It's designed to objectify Mr. Harlow. It's designed to make him the object of a tremendous amount of googly eyes.
Also alludes to Rico Suave.
That's not my favorite part of the song.
What's your favorite part of the song?
Second verse better than the first. I like what he's doing syllabically in the second verse. I do.
Like what Drake was doing syllabically?
It's fine. I'm not saying it's not indebted to some things that Drake have done.
Right.
Do I like this record? Yes. Is this going to be a peak Jack Harlow song? I don't think it is.
I also just want to give Jack Harlow credit for, in the same way that the criticism of Dua Lipa was, she can't dance, so she made a dance song where she actually does dance. Jack Harlow succeeded with an obvious sample. So now he's like, well, I can also succeed with a less obvious sample.
Wow.
But
it bangs.
It bangs.
It does bang.
I'm vanilla, baby. I'll choke you, but I ain't no killer, baby. She 28 telling me I'm still a baby. I get love in Detroit like Skillet, baby. And the thing about your boy is I don't like no whips and chains and you can't tie me down. But you can whip your loving on me. That's right, whip your loving on me. Young J-A-C-K-A-K-A, Rico like Suave, Young Enrique.
John, I have an effervescent snack for you.
No questions this week. Next week, Thanksgiving week, mailbag episode. So many questions. No need to burden you with more questions this week. They're all coming next week. What do you have?
You bought these.
I did buy these, actually.
These are off-brand Pop Rocks, as far as I can tell.
They are. I bought these upstate.
Wait, just a little ASMR.
Yeah.
These are Aftershocks popping candy.
Are you familiar with?
No.
Do you think they're radically different from Pop Rocks?
No, I think they're going to be identical to Pop Rocks, but they come in cherry and grape flavor.
Good packaging.
Great packaging.
Yeah, I fell for the packaging on this.
Where do you want to start?
I'll take grape.
You like grape flavored candy?
No, I want to finish with the one I like.
Okay. It's mature of you.
Thank you.
Oh, did you get the puff of smoke?
Oh, this, it's, wow, the grape really do be graping.
These are, you cannot buy these for children because they are so messy. And yet children are the only people who would appreciate the novelty. Also, why are the grape ones brown?
They've probably been sitting in the pot. To be fair, I bought these a couple months ago.
I give up.
This is not food. This is called the Foreign Candy Company from Iowa. One Foreign Candy Drive.
I'm putting the Pop Rocks in my energy.
Please drink. Forward all packages to me to One Foreign Candy Drive. The rocks. Then there's the little tiny.
Those are just busted rocks.
No, I know, but I wish they were holding their structural integrity more.
I gotta go. I gotta wash my hands. I'm walking off.
You're walking off before even giving a review, a rating? Seriously? Fine. These are, I'm gonna go ahead and give these a 6.5. I literally can't believe I've been abandoned. That is our show. Subscribe Popcast Deluxe on YouTube. It's youtube.com/popcast. Every podcast ever, which includes these episodes and also the audio episodes, is at nytimes.com/popcast. Check us out there. tinyurl.com/popcastdeluxe or /popcast Facebook. That is, you can get in the Discord. Sorry. Take that again.
Yeah, we can't. So we got to do the
cut to the empty chair.
Come back. This is not fair. I feel abandoned here. Fine. Subscribe also to Popcast anywhere you get your audio or audiovisual content. That's Spotify, that's Apple, that's YouTube, etc. Our senior producer is Sawyer Roquet. Our editor is Jamie Heffitz. Special thank you, as always, to Nell Galogli, Pat Gunther, Karen Gans, Leslie Davis, Pedro Rosado. We will be back next week, or at minimum, I will be back next week, because if you look, this is a one-man show now.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches, but there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.